And you said you'd be willing to reserve, or let me know in 3 minutes or earlier.
Oh, I'd be happy to.
I might go past that, but I would appreciate that. Thank you. I'm ready to begin. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Charlie Welton. I represent Ms. Olson, and I'm here to do the best I can in helping you understand these facts. I think it's safe to say that the trial court, looking at all of this from the time of the summary judgment in the underlying matter forward, and the plaintiff's side of the case, just have been like ships passing in the night, and we just haven't connected and seen things the same at all. So it's hard for me to really get into the point of view of the trial judge as she reviewed these matters. And yet, as I do that, and look at the two orders that the trial court issued that are detail-oriented, I have a hard time matching that information set forth in those orders, which are essentially the same as one another, against the statutory requirements in the statute at issue. And I think that's because if the court looked at what we generated in our side of the case, expert testimony to support our claims, it would really be impossible for the trial court to make specific findings, for one, that either our claim was substantially vexatious or substantially frivolous or substantially groundless, which is what's required by the case law, taking a look at the statute and saying, here's what the trial court needs to do to award damage attorney's fees in a situation like this, which is a pretty extreme measure, I think one could agree. And I say that because the trial court and counsel both agreed that Ms. Olson's claims were not vexatious. She didn't do them in bad faith. So we check off the vexatious opportunity to award damages. If you look at whether or not our claims were substantially frivolous, you just can't get there because there are theories that are valid theories that we set forth for legal malpractice, negligence, and breach of fiduciary duty, both of them under that rubric. And they were matched up with qualified expert testimony by an expert familiar with land use issues who looked at the underlying matter, formulated opinions even before we filed the complaint, and submitted an affidavit in support of that, and I'll get to that in a minute, but there were valid legal theories for our claims. There's just no doubt about that. I've been including these kinds of cases in my law practice for more than 25 years, and I'm readily familiar with them. It's not always the kind of cases that you want to have, but I do carry those because people need to have those issues looked at. And you can't say that it was groundless because we did, through the expert, establish a factual basis on the expert's opinions for the theories that we presented. Right? That can't be disputed. Now, a key to how all this happened, and if you look at the court order, she did not determine that either dismissed the vexatious, but did not determine that our claim was either groundless or frivolous. She went through some assumptions about our expert testimony, but they proved out not to be the case. And that sort of takes me to the history of what brought us to this point. It's sort of a tortured history, in fact, but let me talk about that a bit. When the court granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant in this matter, that was upheld on appeal. Right after the court granted the summary judgment, then the defendant requested attorney's fees, and on February 18, 2006, the court denied that motion for attorney's fees. So initially, the court denied the request. Then we appealed, and the defense counter-appealed, cross-appealed on that issue. And what the Court of Appeals said on remand was, trial court, you didn't give us the factual basis for your ruling. So it remanded back for that. So my view was, well, the court's denied it. The court will simply set forth why that happened. But that's not quite what happened when we went back to the trial court. When we went back to the trial court, the trial court asked defense counsel to set up for a hearing. I'm scratching my head wondering why that was. So I actually filed something requesting a status report. Why are we doing this? How does the court see this going forward? And the court then, we appeared for the hearing. Counsel was geared up, had witnesses there, but the court said, well, defense wanted to have an evidentiary hearing. But the court said, well, you know, why don't we not have an evidentiary hearing? Because I'm saying, if you've already ruled on this, the court is just requesting that you say why. And the court, well, actually, both of us wound up acquiescing to the court's request that she rule on the record. I thought, well, that'll work out okay. That's kind of what I think should happen anyway. And then the court issued an extensive ruling on June 12th, granting the attorney's fees. And in that court order, the court inexplicably said, well, I have no option but to grant the attorney's fees, and went on to analyze several aspects of our case, where we presented our expert report, which had been generated before we filed the complaint. Our expert generated an affidavit saying that, you know, what should have happened was the case, and he held those opinions strongly. Then it seemed to me that that was the record that the court should look at, the relationship between plaintiff and her counsel, me, and her expert, and how we relied on all that. It was all there as a standard and usually the case. I still don't know why summary judgment was granted, frankly, but that's my problem. Then, after the court granted the attorney's fees on this extensive order of June 12th, I requested a rehearing on the matter and an evidentiary hearing. And at that evidentiary hearing, we generated substantial testimony. In fact, Mr. Byrne came forth again and submitted a new affidavit confirming his opinions about the matter, that he still held those opinions. And he went back and said, beyond that, you know, I read the court order that said there were fallacies in my opinion, and that I had made assumptions based upon Ms. Olson's presentation. But I went back at counsel's request and read all the record, the stuff I didn't think I had to read in the first place, which, of course, he doesn't have to do. All that could be, as a sideshow, to move over here for a minute, a credibility issue at trial. All that would be a credibility issue at trial. And he went through that very well and explained that, no, there wasn't anything that I missed. There weren't any fallacies. I understood everything. I didn't rely on what Ms. Olson said. She brought to me, and I think as her counsel, I exposed the expert to my client, everything she had, and said, get whatever you need.
At the time she went to the expert, was she pro se or was she represented?
I represented her at that time.
Okay.
I had contacted a couple people in an effort to find an expert, just to give you some explanation on that, and they both had conflicts. What she did is she still had another lawyer representing her on this ongoing matter related to the church, her neighbor, which was still ongoing at that time. Talk about an unpopular cause for her, but nonetheless. And that, Claire Levy, I think. And Claire Levy referred her to Mr. Byrne and said, you ought to go talk to Mr. Byrne, land use expert. And so she did and asked me, can I do that? And I said, sure, go ahead. That's okay. You know, give him whatever he wants.
So I saw something in the briefs or in the record, and maybe you can address this for me, that talked about your client not taking on the expert until she was satisfied that the expert was going to go along with her position or something.
I saw that, and thank you. In the second court order, I think, the trial court basically reiterates everything in her first order, adds a few things, and one of the things she says was, quote, I heard that she didn't hire him until she was confident his opinions were the same as hers. I didn't hear that. And yet, when I look at the circumstances, maybe it's just what makes sense. I mean, maybe she just felt like, well, these things need to be looked at. I don't know.
I've never hired an expert that disagreed with me, have you?
Thank you. That's sort of what I'm getting at. I mean, the standard process is one usually, I've been in that situation where lawyers call me because I've testified on both sides of legal malpractice cases. And the lawyer calls and says, what do you think? Sort of a curbside drive-by, as I put it. And if you think, oh, you know, this just doesn't sound right to me, they're going to just go someplace else. You want at least an indication that the expert is resonating with some of the points you're making. That doesn't mean they're going to be there in the end and reach the same conclusion. Miss Olson, frankly, didn't want that. As she testified, she wanted him to have everything because she was so convinced that she was right, that she, you know, have everything. Look, I know that I'm right about this, so... that's kind of what I didn't know what she meant when she said I heard that, but I resonate kind of with what Judge Roy is saying about that, in that that might have happened in the passing, but it sort of makes sense. Does that help at all? Okay. I think where I was in the process was talking about how then once we had the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Byrne did come in and actually testify. He not only submitted an affidavit to the trial judge, he came and testified about all these things and held firm to his opinions even then and said, you know, Ms. Olson brought to me everything she had, which was extensive, and she's a very good organizer of things, and he picked out what he wanted and asked her about what he wanted to ask her and followed up with questions. Then he worked on it, generated his report, which I got a copy of. I went up and met with him and extensively questioned him about all of these things. I looked into what expert Byrne thought about the Golden Municipal Code and how it all worked. And it made sense to me because his whole point was saying that Mr. Boog had made a mistake in his argument in the Supreme Court. That wasn't the issue. The whole issue and Mr. Byrne's point and the essence of his opinion was that the wrong foundation had been built in the trial court because they pursued the wrong remedy. And once they pursued that remedy of a discretionary hearing, the property rights were out the window, and they should have really pursued just a flat out determination that the church violated the Golden Ordinance is prohibiting an expansion of a non-conforming use. That was the whole thing. Once they went to a remedy of a hearing, it became discretionary, which was their downfall in many aspects, but this one included, if you follow what I'm saying.
Let me ask you a procedural question. I read the notice of appeal and the briefs as only your client appealing. 30% of the fees were awarded against you.
Ouch. I'm appealing too. We're appealing the whole award. What I saw somewhere along the line is the lawyer cannot participate in such an appeal if it's only the lawyer against whom fees are awarded. But I think my sense is that we're basically appealing the court order of fees. And my sense is, and from what I saw,
you're not a party to the appeal.
Pardon me?
You're not a party to the appeal.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you're right about that. Maybe I made a mistake. But I think that from what I read, and counsel hasn't raised that issue in their briefs.
There's no reason for him to.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'll
ask counsel his view of that.
Okay. But our goal is to have the court order set aside for non-compliance with the statute. And I think I did read that the lawyer cannot participate in that. If the award is only against the lawyer, then the lawyer has to come forward on his own part as opposed to not being a party. But I think that's the distinction that I'm relying on in any event, if that's helpful.
You're down to 2 minutes.
I'll just stop right there. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Troy Rackham on behalf of the defendants' appellees in this matter, who I'll refer to collectively as Boog, because there's no material difference between the law firm and Mr. Boog. And Ms. Olson notes in her briefs that the issue in this case is narrow, and we couldn't agree more. The issue is very narrow, and it's simple. Whether the trial court abused its discretion when it reached its findings of fact, concluding that Ms. Olson's claims fell below the standards required by CRS 1317-102. And Boog submits that this court must affirm because the trial court properly exercised its discretion and properly entered findings of fact on that question. This case can be resolved by a simple syllogism. A trial court's award of attorney, it's the law, and it's been the law for a long time, that a trial court's award of attorney's fees is reviewed for abuse of discretion and must be reversed only if not supported by the evidence. The trial court's award in this case was supported by the evidence. Therefore, the trial court's award in this case must be affirmed and not reversed.
The trial court find that it was substantially frivolous or groundless?
It did. If you look at first the June 2008 opinion, on page 3 of that, I shouldn't say opinion, order, trial court specifically discusses CRS 1317-102 and the standard that it requires, this lack of substantial justification, meaning either substantially frivolous, substantially groundless, or substantially vexatious. In the next sentence, then, it says, to guide this analysis, I use CRS 1317-103, which is precisely the statutory makeup.
You never said that it was substantially frivolous and groundless.
The court
said a lot of things after that, but he never said it was frivolous and groundless.
What the court said is, this is the standard I use, frivolous and groundless. I utilize the elements under CRS 1317-103, and then it specifically analyzed the elements. It did not punctuate its analysis of those elements with saying, because I've concluded my analysis on all these elements, I find that their claim lacks substantial justification. But Boob submits that it doesn't need to. Once it properly sets out the elements to determine whether a claim lacks substantial justification and decides those elements, it's purely semantics to say, because of my finding of these elements, I find that the claim lacks substantial justification. It's akin to a jury reviewing a breach of contract instruction, finding all the elements of breach of contract, but not writing at the end, because of our findings of these elements, we find that the defendant breached its contract. It doesn't matter because it's already concluded the necessary elements to reach that decision. And Boob submits that the trial court did precisely that in this case. And if the court looks at the City of Aurora versus Colorado State Engineers case from the Colorado Supreme Court, the Supreme Court follows that exact same analysis. Indeed, it uses almost the exact same language, saying that 1317-102 provides that fees shall be awarded if the trial court finds lack substantial justification. And then the very next sentence says, to guide this analysis, courts should use the elements in CRS 1317-103, which is precisely what the trial court did in this case. And here there's plenty of evidence to support the trial court's findings of fact. To back up a little bit, it's important to remember the trial court held three hearings on this issue after remand, a hearing in May, and then two hearings in October. It took the evidence of Ms. Olson, took the evidence of Ms. Olson's expert, and of the defendant's expert, Justice Zubofsky. It also received an evidence, a booklet of evidence from the plaintiff and a booklet of evidence from the defendant. This is a classic case where the trial court held the hearings and entered the findings of fact. And of course, it's the trial court's prerogative, it's the trial court's sole prerogative to resolve those questions of fact, and the trial court did so in its April 1st, 2009 order. I would like to discuss with the court briefly the plenty of evidence that supported the trial court's findings. First, Mr. Byrne testified at the hearing in October 8th of 2008, and I'm going through these in order that they present in the record, that he had never litigated a 1983 case. He testified that he had never handled a 1983 appeal. He testified that he never orally argued a case ever. And of course, to back up a little bit, Mr. Byrne's opinion was Mr. Boob laid the wrong foundation so that the Colorado Supreme Court could not affirm on the 1983 case, on the 1983 claim. But Mr. Byrne had never, ever handled a 1983 case or appeal. Mr. Byrne testified that he had never been a counsel on an appellate brief. He did not review the trial transcript in this from the underlying case. He only reviewed portions of it, even though he rendered the opinion that Mr. Boob did not present an adequate foundation at trial in the underlying case. Sixth, the second amended complaint filed by Mr. Boob alleged at page 4 of the complaint that the Golden Municipal Court afforded an absolute right to a against an extension of a nonconforming use. That was the very factual foundation on which Mr. Byrne's opinion was based. His opinion was based on the fact that according to him, Mr. Boob never alleged that the Golden Municipal Code afforded an absolute right against the extension of a nonconforming use. But the second amended complaint at page 4 that was filed in the underlying case said just that. Judge Barnhill, in his order, and again, this is in the findings of fact, it located the transcript, that October 8th, 2008 transcript at page 74, Judge Barnhill, in his order, after Mr. Boob tried the case on behalf of Ms. Olson, found that the Golden Municipal Code had an absolute prohibition against the extension of a nonconforming use, the very factual foundation that Mr. Byrne claimed didn't exist. A simple review of Judge Barnhill's order would have revealed that it did, in fact, exist, which is what the trial court...
Wasn't it the theory that That was what should have been pursued instead of the 1983 claim?
That was part of the theory. That was not instead of the 1983 claim, but that should have been pursued as part of the 1983 claim. And Boog submits that it was pursued from the second amended complaint that he filed on forward, and there's no way that Judge Barnhill could reach a conclusion under his 1983 analysis that the Golden Municipal Code prohibited an extension of nonconforming use unless it was pursued. Mr. Byrne admitted that on cross-examination at the hearing in this case. Mr. Byrne admitted that the contention that the Golden Municipal Code had an absolute prohibition against nonconforming use was part of the underlying trial. Yet he reached an opinion that Mr. Boog was negligent by not pursuing that claim. Mr. Byrne admitted that he didn't review the entire appellate record from the underlying case, yet he opined that Mr. Boog was negligent in his pursuit of the appeal because he did not claim that the Golden Municipal Code prohibited an extension of nonconforming use.
You can get a variance. It's not an absolute bar, is it?
Right. Which is what the Colorado Supreme Court concluded. The Colorado Supreme Court in the underlying case reviewed the Golden Municipal Code and said it affords discretion to the planning committee, the city of Golden, and because it affords discretion, there is no Section 1983 right. So even though Mr. Boog won in the trial court and he won at the Court of Appeals, the Colorado Supreme Court reversed precisely because of the discretion afforded by the Planning Commission under the Golden Municipal Code. But it was Mr. Byrne's opinion that if Mr. Boog had simply alleged and argued that the Golden Municipal Code prohibited an extension of nonconforming use, the result would have been different. And it's that opinion which formed the very foundation of the plaintiff's case, and it's that opinion that fell below 1317.102. And I shouldn't say that opinion. It's the plaintiff and plaintiff's counsel reliance on that opinion, because it's an unreasonable reliance on opinion, that fell below the standards required of CRS 1317.102.
The expert wasn't just a sham. I mean, he had some qualifications and he did review the record. And so perhaps you could fairly say that he wasn't a very good expert or didn't do a very good job, but does that rise to the level of no substantial justification for the lawsuit at all? I mean, there has to be a winner and a loser.
Right, and Boog submits that it does. In most cases, I would agree. There's going to be, in almost every professional malpractice defense, there's going to be an expert that says A and an expert that says not A, and it's up to the jury or the finder of fact to resolve that difference. The difference here is critical, and that is they obtained an expert who opined about a factual situation that was demonstrably false. Starting from the second amended complaint in the underlying case forward, it was demonstrably false that Mr. Boog never alleged that the Golden Municipal Code prohibited an extension of nonconforming use. And it's not, Boog submits, reasonable to rely on an expert's report when you know that the expert report is assuming a falsity.
Did it make that finding that it was demonstrably false?
The court made the finding that, well, it didn't make the, you didn't use those specific words that it was demonstrably false. The court did make the finding, though, that Mr. Byrne's opinion was based on the contention that Mr. Boog never alleged that the Golden Municipal Code prohibited an extension of a nonconforming use, and that was false, starting with the second amended complaint forward. And indeed, the trial court looked at the transcript from the oral argument of the Colorado Supreme Court and noted that Mr. Boog, in that transcript, made the very argument the plaintiff was and Mr. Byrne was claiming he didn't make. And so this is a different circumstance. This is not a lawyer relying on a radiologist to interpret a radiological film, or a lawyer relying.
Park didn't say that he had made the very same argument. It said even if he had couched his argument exactly as plaintiffs assert he should have, which suggests that the argument, I'm looking at page 5 of the, under finding heading number 6, that seemed to suggest that he's saying that the argument may have been somewhat different, but it would not have been successful, not that they had made the exact same argument.
If the court looks at, and specifically, page 4 of the April 1st, 2009 order, starting in paragraph 1A, the court finds, quote, defendant Boog counters that he asserted both theories in the underlying suit in his amended complaint. This court finds that such a theory was espoused in plaintiff's second claim for relief. The trial court held that he did have such a right. The Court of Appeals affirmed that holding, and then it goes to the Colorado Supreme Court decision. Boog submits that that finding necessarily is a finding that Boog did allege the claim, and then it pursued through the appellate process.
What about the difference between the client relying upon the expert's opinion and being sanctioned, and her attorney relying on the expert's opinion and being sanctioned, assuming for the purposes of the question that the opinion was as bad as you say it is?
Well, and let's get to that. And the first, I think, analysis is to get to your question that you asked of the appellants. Mr. Welton and his firm are not parties to the appeal. They did not amend the caption, as you need to do if a court awards attorney's fees against you. So that part of the appeal is not ripe for the court's determination. But with respect to Ms. Olson's appeal, this is a different circumstance than a client who goes to an attorney and expects and relies on that attorney's advice. The evidence in this case, as presented in the October 8th, 2008 hearing, and more importantly in the October 30th, 2008 hearing, showed, and this is Exhibit 3 in defendants or plaintiff's exhibits, Ms. Boog created a six-page single-spaced memo that she took to her expert and said, here's my opinions on why Boog malpracticed and what Big Boog didn't do in the case, which in and of itself may be okay. But what Mr. Byrne did is recycle most of that analysis from the six pages and put it in his report. That's clearly not okay. And Ms. Olson testified she knew the standards associated with 1317.102. She knew that she had rendered these opinions in her, or these statements in her analysis to Mr. Boog, and she retained, or Mr. Byrne, excuse me, and she retained Mr. Byrne only after he agreed to her analysis contained in her memorandum. So this is not a circumstance where, the normal circumstance where an unsophisticated client hires the lawyer and then relies on the lawyer's judgment.
Well, I take it she didn't believe that it was substantially groundless or substantially frivolous when she handed him a six-page memorandum.
Subjectively, she did not believe that it was. I don't think there's any basis in the record to conclude that subjectively she believed that it was lacking substantial justification and therefore went to this expert in bad faith to try to support what she subjectively believed.
But didn't she rely then on the expert to look at it and say, well, I disagree with you here, here, and here?
Well, Boog submits that the standard under 1317.102 is objectively reasonable. And it's not objectively reasonable based on the facts in the case to rely on an expert after you've gone to the expert, provided the expert with your analysis of the case, and doing that knowing that you didn't tell the you didn't give the expert the critical information about the fact that this claim had been pled from the second amended complaint forward, that you didn't give the expert the critical part of the oral argument transcript that shows Mr. Boog.
The record seems to reflect that she made the entire file available to him.
She did.
And he's the expert.
And he selected what he wanted to review.
Well, it was, I think, based on her testimony at the October 30th, 2008 hearing, it was more of a collaborative process. But certainly he testified he had the ability to review anything he wanted had he asked for it.
You and I have both hired experts. I've hired engineers and I've hired doctors. And I go to them, and I'm a lawyer, and I have a case. And I tell them what my theory of the case is. I tell them what evidence I think supports that theory of the case, and ask them what they think.
Sure.
Do you do the same thing?
I think it's customary to do
that. I think that's fairly customary. So at what point did she jump off the rails?
When, and I don't think it's fair to say she jumped off the rails. Her team collectively, her and her lawyer and her expert jumped off the rails. And it's at the point where it's demonstrably, the expert clearly has the obligation to tell her, look, you're telling me this was not pursued, and it clearly was. And it's at that point where she's got the obligation to go back and say, oh, it was alleged. I can't pursue this case. I need to dismiss the claims, which she never
probably went, in the normal course of things, I realized this particular plaintiff has some background in the law and apparently knows how to do some research in the law and whatever. But, I mean, that wouldn't that be her counsel's obligation, and wouldn't it be even the expert witness's obligation to disclose problems with the opinion?
And I'm out
to
of
her.
Time.
I mean, and maybe not even to her, but it's pretty clear that didn't happen.
I'm out of time, but I would love to answer the court's question.
I'd love to have you answer the question on my time.
There was not evidence presented in the record that that conversation, that the realization with the expert occurred and that conversation occurred. But respectfully, because the trial court's findings are reviewed here for whether there's evidence in the record, an analysis of that hypothetical doesn't really matter to the court's ultimate analysis as to whether there's evidence to support the trial court's finding, because clearly there is evidence in the record in this case.
Thank you. Just a couple points in follow-up. The court, in fact, did not make a determination of groundless or frivolous. She went through some, looked at the factors, but didn't tie those in. And again, I submit because they weren't there, because Mr. Burns' opinion stood fast and steady to the end on negligence, breach, and causation of damages to the very end.
Ms. Dubofsky, while she disagreed, didn't think the opinion was ridiculous or clearly undefendable.
Yeah, she testified that, in fact, her expectation was that the matter would go to trial and Mr. Byrne would testify to the jury and she would testify to the jury and the jury would determine the outcome. I think that's right. And in fact, looking at the issue, I don't think what Ms. Dubofsky has to say really matters. It's what happened between the plaintiff and her counsel and the expert. And I must say, Mr. Byrne was really the right expert to opine regarding the position of Mr. Boog, because he was the land use expert. Ms. Dubofsky admittedly was the appellate expert, but by the time they got there, that it wouldn't be fair to judge, I don't think, that whole issue on the appellate issue, because as I say, that really wasn't the issue. It was how the matter was set up in the trial court. Certainly, Boog gave lip service to the fact that the ordinance shall prohibit expansion of a nonconforming use, but that got lost when he pursued solely the remedy of a discretionary hearing. Because
counsel,
yes,
how do you respond to the argument that the trial court addressed substantial justification, ticked off the elements, and the only thing it left off was, and based on my finding of these elements, I conclude it's substantially frivolous or substantially groundless?
Well, if you look at the elements, don't match up with the analysis. The elements are, was there prior investigation? And here there was. We had the report in hand before the suit was filed. Was it done in bad faith? Court dismissed that out of hand. It was not done in bad faith. Were the facts reasonably in conflict? And maybe that's where she gets into the issues about thinking that Mr. Byrne had fallacies in his opinion, but it turns out he didn't. He came in and said, there were no fallacies. I understood this to be just as it is, and my opinion stand. The court ignored that in the second version of the order. Not frivolous. We had a viable theory, not groundless. There was expert opinion in place. The court went back. One of the things that irks me a little bit is the court went back and looked at the analysis of the Supreme Court opinion as regards adequate remedy at law. And the Supreme Court opinion actually says, we don't find that Ms. Olson's right was a property right, it was a procedural right. Therefore, she had an adequate remedy at law because of that. And defendants submitted their brief, they changed the language to even if she only had a procedural right, or even if she had a property right, rather, she still had an adequate remedy at law. That changes dramatically the reading of that Supreme Court opinion and turns it on its head. So that's just one example of how the defense analysis was picked up by the trial court in a way that was really unfair to Mr. Byrne's opinion and unfair to the way the Supreme Court decided the issue in the end. Thanks.
The case will be deemed submitted. We thank both counsel for their briefs and arguments. A written opinion will issue in due course. The court will be in recess, subject to call, and the bailiff may pronounce.